Good evening. It's Saturday, May 30th, 2020. As former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin faces third-degree murder and manslaughter charges for the death of George Floyd, protesters across the country say that's not enough.
If they want peace, they're going to have to give us justice.
Dr. Cornell West speaks out, saying the system is broken and it cannot repair itself.
You have Brother George, where it is so clear it is a lynching at the highest level. Nobody can deny it. And I thank God that we have people in the streets. Can you imagine this kind of lynching taking place and people are indifferent?
And as educators begin strategizing a way to reopen school doors, the Oakland School Board votes on a resolution to include Arab studies in their ethnic studies program.
Not just about learning solutions of communities of color globally and here in the United States, and how they can actually, how that can build empathy and connection and solidarity across communities.
With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota, and this is the KPFA Weekend Evening News. People across the country are taking to the streets since former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin squeezed the life out of George Floyd by kneeling on his neck as another officer watched and two others held down the rest of Floyd's body. On Friday, Hennepin County Attorney Mike Freeman announced Derek Chauvin is being charged with third-degree murder and manslaughter charges. Many protesters in Minneapolis and around the country say that simply isn't enough. Chanel Rivers lives in Minneapolis and has been protesting for the last few days.
I just felt like this was happening in my community, and I needed to find a way to support. Today, we did another peaceful protest. We shut down 35W, and I think that's the point of protesting, to make it uncomfortable. We want you to be as uncomfortable as we are. And I feel like that mission was accomplished, and I think we have to continue to apply that pressure until we see the changes that we want to see.
And Chanel, the charges came out for one of the officers, and also the officers were fired within one day of this. How do you feel about that?
I really do appreciate Mayor Fry's immediate steps to take action, getting the FBI involved right off the bat, getting these officers fired, but it's still not justice, right? We want to see all four of these officers arrested. We want to see all four of these officers charged. If you watch that video, I don't even understand how they came to a third degree. There was intent to kill. Anytime you sit on somebody's neck for that amount of time and they're unconscious, clearly for 2 minutes and 53 seconds, your intention was to kill them. And the fact that those officers who are supposed to protect and serve sat there and protected him while he did that, I feel like they all need to be locked up. And I don't think the city is not going to accept it. So if they want peace, they're going to have to give us justice.
Rivers says people aren't quite getting the true picture of what the protests in Minneapolis look like.
I mean, every protest that I've been at, they're handing out masks, they're handing out food, they're handing out water, whatever you need to keep that going. But it's always with love. I mean, we even had folks today asking about elderly people that might need toilet paper or other essentials since they can't get to grocery stores right now because they're closing grocery stores in these local communities. I feel like that is the image that they need to see. Post a picture of somebody passing out food, post a picture of somebody passing out resources, because that's what we're doing. We're trying to create change in a peaceful manner, but we're also supporting our community in the process.
Stephanie Morrison Gandhi is an activist, an artist, and a scholar of Afro-multicultural education. She participated in the creation of a community mural along with many others.
The piece demonstrates a Black boy with his outstretched arms, and then on his t-shirt it says humanity unseen, and then it has like kind of a blackout on his eyes. And the imagery is really striking, and we had permanent markers for and space around the image of the boy where people could write and contribute. And it was really more like moving to see a small child, I'd say probably like 8 or 9, write on the mural, "Don't hurt me, police."
Morrison Gandhi says she'd like people to rethink the term peaceful protesting.
Unfortunately, we're not at peace. I think we're all gathering together and not really exhibiting violence or causing destruction, but I don't think there's peace in people right now. So I would definitely say the narrative is that the city is hurting.
Gwen Lloyd, another Twin Cities resident with a background in racial justice work, says he's tired of seeing different versions of this story play out in Minnesota.
Minneapolis has sadly now had another citizen die from excessive force. It is within an unhealthy culture that continues to reaffirm that the way to engage with Black and Brown men and women is to take an aggressive stance and have a inhumane expectation of how Black people should respond to officers. What exactly should we do? Should we get our license and registration out or shouldn't we? Should we have our hands up or not? Should we stand peacefully and then be told that we're resisting arrest? At some point, I think it does become a responsibility of people in power to leverage their power to dismantle the systems that continue to be in play and put citizens in danger.
Those are the voices of Glenn Lloyd, Stephanie Morrison Gandhi, and Chanel Rivers speaking about the actions in Minnesota in the fight for justice for George Floyd. Today, Wanda Johnson, the mother of Oscar Grant, led a virtual town hall meeting called The Pain and Suffering We Face. When I spoke with Johnson ahead of her meeting, she reflected on what the death of George Floyd, some 11 years after the death of her son, is bringing up for her and why she continues to fight.
I looked at the video first of my condolences to his family. When I saw it, I wept because we have such a long way to go. It's just heartbreaking for me to see what happened to him, and the officers around did not even have a heart to try to stop their partner. That blue line is so thick, as we can see on television and through videos, how thick the blue line is, where even when you see your partner doing wrong, you turn the other way so you can say you didn't know what he was doing or she was doing. It's unacceptable.
People across the country are standing up and protesting. Does that give you extra hope, or kind of where are you on your hope spectrum today?
My hope spectrum is that this nation will take a deep look at it and will begin to sit down and hear the voices of the unheard. And we sit at the table and begin to talk and begin to dismantle our judicial system and rebuild it where it needs to be rebuilt at.
And a lot of people believed that with Oscar's case, which was seen across the country, that maybe that was the first step toward change. And here we are 11 years later, and things haven't changed all that much. What keeps you going and what keeps you working at this in spite of the magnitude of what we're up against?
Well, I'm in this fight forever until I die. And my fight is to work to try to help it so that other families don't have to go through the same thing what I've gone through. And still here we're today and they're going through the same things. And so I have to continue, you know, to fight. And I've been quoting what Martin Luther King has said, you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Darkness cannot drive out darkness. You know, only light can do that. And hate cannot drive out hate. Only love can do that.
That's Wanda Johnson, the mother of the late Oscar Grant.
The connection between former vice president and now Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden and former Ukrainian president Petro Poroshenko is big news in Ukraine. Recently, tapes of phone calls were released that show Poroshenko's very subservient attitude toward the U.S. Current President Volodymyr Zelensky recently commented on the Biden-Poroshenko relationship and the former president's legal problems. Nikolai Petro is a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. We asked him about the Biden-Poroshenko relationship and the comments of a former U.S. State Department official on who should run Ukraine.
President Zelensky had a press conference, his first press conference a year in office. And one of the things he said there was he really said that Poroshenko is getting what he deserves. He wouldn't be surprised at all if there were prosecutions of him and his team. He certainly deserved it. And that this was not the last bell that Ukrainians would hear regarding, again, Poroshenko's abuse of power. And of course, the whole scandal involves the fact that the United States so clearly backed Poroshenko, including in his electoral campaign.
Did the comments of Victoria Nuland a few years ago get much play in Ukraine? The idea that the U.S. had its guy, that it wanted to be president, and the U.S. was calling the shots. Was that a big deal, or was that just not covered very much?
It was covered, but there's a division in the Ukrainian press. So there is the completely loyal press, which supported then President Poroshenko and the change in government that occurred after February 2014. And then there was the press that would argue critically that there was something else going on, that we weren't being told the full story, and that it seems, this has been a constant theme throughout, there have been endless revelations about this, in particular the role of the U.S. Ambassador Jeffrey Pyatt, who was so clearly a conduit, and including the head of the intelligence services, Nalivaychenko. This is almost like a standing joke, you know. His first daily meeting was always at the U.S. Embassy, then he would go to work. This is just a running theme. So again, none of this is shockingly new. On the other hand, we now have, if you will, some tangible evidence of the words that Poroshenko used in talking to Biden and Biden's actual response. Biden is actually much more cautious. I think he understands that any sort of conversation of this kind has the possibility of being leaked, and he doesn't commit to much on what we hear of the tape.
That's University of Rhode Island Professor Nikolai Petro. The effects of the Fukushima nuclear disaster in Japan are still being felt years later. Paul Gunter is the director of the Reactor Oversight Project at Beyond Nuclear in Tacoma, Maryland. He talked about the accident and its aftermath.
The accident that happened at Fukushima Daiichi following the earthquake and tsunami on March 11, 2011, is still a serious concern, both to the environment and the public health. They still have not been able to locate and retrieve the melted reactor cores for the three GE Mark I reactors they were operating at full power on that day. And there was multiple accidents, initially hydrogen gas explosions that destroyed the containment systems and the release of radioactivity into the atmosphere. So they've been trying to control the temperature of those melted cores since that day now. And they've been building up incredibly large inventories of radioactive cooling water that has been stored in a ever-growing tank farm of probably now nearly 1,000 tanks, you know, the size of a refinery, oil refinery storage tank, that are filled with this radioactive water.
What do you think can be done with that water that would be safer?
There's not really any other alternative right now to releasing it to the environment other than to continue to store it on site and to expand the tank farm. I think that that's generally an accepted management plan. You know, the whole area around Fukushima Daiichi is abandoned primarily, so they could expand the tank farm and just continue to store it. But to release it to the Pacific Ocean, it's sort of like a reverse tsunami, only this time of radioactive water back into the ocean. And that's going to impact the local fishing industry. It's going to cause the release of radioactivity. And while, you know, it will be diluted into the ocean, there is this natural process where the biology concentrates that radioactivity, and then in a bioaccumulation, like in algae, and then smaller fish eat the algae, and then it biomagnifies up through the food chain, and then you get bluefin tuna eating the fish and then migrating back over to the west coast of the United States.
That's Paul Gunter of Beyond Nuclear.
And you're listening to the Weekend Evening News on KPFA 94.1 FM in Berkeley, KFCF 88.1 in Fresno, K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Since Governor Gavin Newsom began loosening the statewide shelter-in-place order, non-essential businesses and workers have been eagerly looking forward to getting back to work and picking up the pieces of an uncertain future. Meanwhile, school and academic institutions have also been navigating through various challenges to meet the needs of students. Earlier this week, the Oakland Board of Education voted on a resolution to expand ethnic education curriculum to include Arab Americans. Critics say there's still more to be done. KPFA's Lola Akamu reports.
This week, California Superintendent of Schools Tony Thurmond announced that California's faculty and staff should expect major changes when schools come back into session. During his virtual news conference, he said students should expect a combination of in-person and virtual learning to continue. In a 4-2 vote, the Oakland Unified School Board voted on Wednesday to include Arab American studies as part of the ethnic curriculum taught in Oakland schools in an effort to meet the demands of a diverse student population. A coalition of teachers, students, local organizations, and activists have been leading the charge to highlight the need to include Arab American studies for California students to counter pro-Israel and Islamophobic sentiments. Lara Kaswani is executive director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center, AROC. She says having a diverse ethnic studies curriculum will give students a leg up in a global society.
Well, you know, we just recently completed a survey, our youth survey on representations of Arabs across the Bay Area high school classrooms. And only about 3% of them said they actually received education in the classroom about Arab history, culture, and experiences. And so there's a lot of gaps in the classroom, in particular of marginalized communities and racialized communities. And that's what ethnic studies attempts to fill. It's not just about learning solutions of communities of color globally and here in the United States, and how they can actually, how that can build empathy and connection and solidarity across communities.
Kaswani says there are a lot of gaps in the current curriculum, especially towards Arab studies and underrepresented communities overall.
The practitioners who developed this California-wide curriculum included, as part of the original four disciplines, Arab American studies under the rubric of Asian American studies. In addition, they also included Pacific Islander studies, both of things that were actually missing from the current ethnic studies curriculum that's been offered in California. And that had received a lot of backlash. And so the Board of Education passing the resolution in Oakland on Wednesday was really echoing support for the work of these ethnic studies practitioners and saying that there is value and a need to include Arab American studies within ethnic studies work across the state of California.
Again, that was Lara Kaswani, Executive Director of the Arab Resource and Organizing Center. Reporting for KPFA News, I'm Lola Kumu.
U.S. attempts to overthrow the Venezuelan government of Nicolas Maduro have so far not been successful, but that doesn't mean Washington has given up. Joe Emmersberger is an independent journalist who's been following the situation. We asked him if the U.S. has lost its edge when it comes to getting rid of governments it doesn't like.
Everyone talks about Vietnam, the Vietnam War being a defeat for the United States. Well, in the way it was, but by the time it was defeated, they killed millions of people. They killed, like, in Indochina, 4 million people overall. You know, so yeah, there's blunders and incompetence and hubris and all that stuff, but there's also tremendous damage. You know, so in the case of Venezuela, the real damage is being done is through these economic sanctions that Trump ramped up in August of 2017. Obama initiated them, but Trump ramped them up dramatically in August of 2017. They became financial sanctions, which locked Venezuela out of financial markets and also prohibited a U.S.-based company, a Venezuelan-owned company named Citgo, from being able to send any dividends or profits back to Venezuela. That cost them billions of dollars. So that was a tremendous blow because they were already in the middle of a major economic crisis. So this was just it's like somebody in a hospital already terminally ill, and then somebody comes in and starts attacking them, assaulting them.
I've heard that the Venezuelan economy is actually doing better, and that's helped Maduro solidify his position. Is that true?
You know, I think better is a little relative. They're still going through a horrendous downturn. There hasn't been any growth, but there was somewhat of a stabilization. It looked like there might have been growth in 2020, but then they got hit with the pandemic. And in addition to that, Trump, as the administration, keeps ramping up the sanctions because they ramped them up again to go after even secondary suppliers to Venezuela. So they're trying to cut off not only Venezuela, but even the people who try to deal with them. They're exerting tremendous financial and political pressure on them and legal pressure to prevent them from even supplying Venezuela with any kind of, with just engaging with them in basic trade. You know, it's only the two major countries that have, of course, kind of defied that have been Russia and China. But they've been successful in intimidating various countries and companies all over the world. You know, they're afraid to deal with Venezuela now. I mean, just to routine transactions. So every time there's some improvement, they ramp up the sanctions again.
That's independent journalist Joe Emmersberger.
This week, many schools ended their academic year with virtual goodbyes and, in some cases, parades of teachers. This fifth grader awaited a parade of teachers from the elementary school in downtown Lafayette with a dozen of his family members by his side.
My name is Marion, and I'm graduating from fifth grade and going to sixth grade. A lot of my family is with me, and we're going to have a fun graduation.
What would it have been like if we weren't in a pandemic?
It would have been, like, more happy, more...
More people.
Would it have happened at school? Would there have been a big thing?
Yes, it would have been big.
Yes. Okay.
So, Mom, what's it like for you to go through this moment in the streets of Lafayette with your son instead of in a recognized, formal way?
It's okay. I'm just happy that he's graduating and we got to do something. Not, you know, they tried to make something happen out here in Lafayette, so that's good.
Talk about how many people you have here and where everybody came from to be here this afternoon.
Okay, I got my auntie, I got my mom, my stepdad, my mother-in-law, my boyfriend, my brother, my brothers, my cousins. Everybody came from Vallejo, Richmond, and we're in Lafayette.
What's been the most challenging part of being sheltered in place for the past few months?
Being a teacher at home to my child.
And what's been the silver lining, if you've been able to find any?
It's been getting a lot of more rest and more peaceful.
Did this impact your employment?
Yes, I was off for a little while to teach my son, but now I'm back at work and I catch BART. So that's really been a hassle, and having to wear the mask and gloves, and it's just been really scary.
Where do you go for work?
I work for Kaiser in San Francisco.
How busy is it every day?
The BART is actually good right now because no one's on there because everybody's working from home, but I have to go in. I'm an essential worker, unfortunately.
Have you felt any sadness in terms of what it would have looked like for this moment of transition for him compared to how it is?
It's fine for me. The emotional part is him just growing up and knowing that I'm having a sixth grader and a kid's going to middle school. So that's the most emotional part. And I can't believe he's this old now.
That's the mother of a Lafayette Elementary School fifth grader.
The COVID-19 Global Solidarity Coalition was launched earlier this month with a manifesto signed by thousands of people and organizations all over the world. The goal of the coalition is to establish guidelines, principles, and priorities for dealing with the current coronavirus pandemic and to end what it sees as a neoliberal assault on the environmental and social structures that protect the health and well-being of people everywhere. David Vine is a professor of anthropology at American University in Washington, D.C., and one of the founders of the coalition. We asked him how the coalition came to be.
The coalition got started about 2 months ago out of a recognition by many people, activists, academics, writers, artists, others, that there are people around the world, of course, experiencing something very similar in the same moment. People being locked down, people being touched, of course, very directly, personally by COVID. And people suddenly, I think, seeing the world in a different light. People seeing the inequalities and forms of violence that, of course, have been part of our world for a very long time, but that are all the more obvious in this moment of pandemic. And there are people around the world who I think have felt motivated to more than ever to change something, to change the world, and to take advantage of this really historic moment when so much is changing, to transform the world and move it in a direction toward greater equality and justice, and to try to erase some of the inequalities.
Is it too early, or do you have plans already on how you're going to go about implementing the program that you want to see implemented?
The first step was to craft this COVID-19 Global Solidarity Manifesto that we wrote together over a couple weeks, and already 3,000 people have signed in a very short period of time, which were encouraged by people around the world. And I should say this coalition, it's made up of people from at least 20 countries. So it really is quite transnational. And the signatories are from an even larger number of countries. So we've launched this Global Solidarity Manifesto, and it's available on our website. And now we need to figure out, how are we going to make the demands and the vision we outline in this COVID-19 Global Solidarity Manifesto a reality.
That's David Vine of the COVID-19 Global Solidarity Coalition. And for more information, you can go to covidglobalsolidarity.org.
Dr. Cornell West, speaking to CNN host Anderson Cooper, said that we are witnessing the failure of America as a social experiment, and that the system cannot reform itself.
And what we've seen in America is now these chickens coming home to roost. You're reaping what you sow. And in this instant, you have Brother George, where it is so clear, it is a lynching at the highest level. Nobody can deny it. And I thank God that we have people in the streets. Can you imagine this kind of lynching taking place and people are indifferent? People don't care? People are callous. You have just a few people out there with signs. I recall the moments in which during the Reagan years, there was a few of us out there. In the 60s, you had masses out there. Now you've got a younger generation of all of these different colors and genders and sexual orientations saying, we won't take it any longer. But you know what's sad about it, though, brother, at the deepest level? It looks as if the system cannot reform itself. We've tried black faces in high places. Too often our black politicians, professional class, middle class, become too accommodated to the capitalist economy, too accommodated to the militarized nation state, too accommodated to the market-driven culture tied with celebrity status, power, fame, all of that superficial stuff that means so much to so many fellow citizens.
That was Dr. Cornell West speaking to CNN host Anderson Cooper. And the weather in the San Francisco Bay Area: showers tonight with lows in the 60s, cloudy tomorrow with highs in the mid-70s. In the Fresno area, partly cloudy tonight with lows in the 60s, highs near 80 for tomorrow. That's it for this evening's news. Thanks to Lola Akamu and Ann Garrison for helping to prepare tonight's news. And to you, our listeners, for tuning in. Carla West is at the controls. With David Rosenberg, I'm Sharon Sabota. Good evening.